Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that gives us an opportunity to meet people who have made a difference in our lives. This is Bob Willard, and we will be visiting today with Yana Starks, who is the owner of the independent used bookstore Caveat Emptor. Caveat Emptor, which sits across the street from the Monroe County Courthouse, has just celebrated its 30th year in business. And many of you may know Yanis as one of the best-informed and successful player of WFIU's Ether Game. For the next hour or so, we'll ask Yanis a few questions, play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. Yanis, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yanis, David Hackett wrote in the Herald Times on June 9th of this year, "Most of the stories being written about independent bookstores these days are obituaries. Since 1994, fully half the independent bookstores in the United States have passed away, according to the American Booksellers Association." Yanis Starks is bucking the trend. Caveat Emptor stands in stark contrast to the huge chain stores that have come to dominate the market with their coffee bars, sofas, and tables of bestsellers. Nearly 50,000 titles are crammed into Caveat Emptor's 2,800 square feet, with shelves stretching as high as 9 rows up. There are boxes overflowing with more books that crowd the narrow aisles. Cartoons and newspaper clippings and items of interest are taped randomly to shelves. In the corner sits the owner, listening to classical music and reading a book about natural history. Now, we have a picture of the place. Let's meet the spirit behind this oasis of culture. Yanis, how did Caveat Emptor come about?
Well, several of us were at loose ends back about 1970, 71, and I was in the process of deciding that an academic career was not going to be for me, and other friends were looking around for something else to do because they were not happy in their current jobs. And we thought that Bloomington needed a used bookstore. There hadn't been one since the 1950s, I'm told. And I had gotten used to shopping at one in Indianapolis and I thought that a university town really ought to have one. So we got together, put together our capital, our libraries.
You used your own books to start this?
Well, certainly. I mean, we had, you know, I mean, I had been accumulating things from my own collection for years and years and years. I've been collecting since I was, you know, old enough to read. And, of course, you know, once we decided that we were going to start selling these as well as collecting them ourselves, we would go out to yard sales, thrift shops, flea markets, and what have you to rummage up the stock. I think that's what however used book dealer starts, you know, usually partly with his own collection, quite often a focused collection in some topical area that he may be an expert in perhaps. And then just going out and finding cheap books wherever you can find them.
And then you just put them on shelves and say, come.
We put them on shelves. We initially started out also selling recordings and new books and posters because we needed to have something to draw people into the shop until we had built up a more respectable inventory of used books. And it was a way of getting people to come into the store. The record market in Bloomington was expensive, and we thought we could find a niche by selling things at a discount, which we managed to do.
And these were used LPs?
No, these were new LPs. These
oh,
were
new
these,
LPs.
These were new recordings. We had a used section as well. But we thought that would certainly be – college students always like to have music, and we thought that that would be a way of attracting their attention. And in fact, that was indeed the case. And we had some fantastic sales and promotions, and we got, you know, co-op ad money from the record labels and really got into it. But it was a difficult way to make money, and I really feel sorry for anybody trying to make a profit in the record business. But it did manage to get us noticed, and by the time we finally got out of the new books and the new records, we had an established clientele for the used books. And quite a credible inventory.
Were you always located where you are now, right there on the square?
No, this is our – we are now in our fourth location. We started out on in a little hole in the wall on 4th Street across from the old fire station, across from where WFHB now resides. And after about a year and a half or so, we moved to Indiana Avenue, 110 South Indiana, in the building that White Rabbit occupied up until recently and is now a Starbucks. And then after a number of years, we moved into a house on Dunn between 3rd and 4th Street, which is now a used clothing store. And finally, we managed to get to the square. And it's our biggest location and certainly the most visible to people who aren't just college students.
And how long have you been there?
I think it'll be 10 years pretty soon. We assumed an old lease of somebody else, and then we signed a new one about, maybe 4 years ago.
So other businesses on either side of you have come and gone, but you've stayed there.
Yes.
How did you come up with the name Caveat Emptor? Because it has a different connotation there.
Back in 70, 71, there was a lot of consumer consciousness in the air. And somehow during our midnight skull sessions, it seemed like a good idea. In retrospect, considering some of the comments we've gotten on our name, we might have picked a better one. But after 3 years of doing business, we're known by this name all over Indiana, and it would be a shame to change it now.
So buyer beware has not kept people away from
it. It has not kept people away.
Well, you're getting a used book. Who knows what's in there, right?
Right. Although if it turns out that a book is incomplete or not, not as advertised, we will certainly make it right to the customer.
What is the formula that has helped mold the success and longevity of this business?
I guess a lot of it has to do with stubbornness, just not giving up, when the hard times come, which occasionally will happen. Mostly it's simply a matter of paying attention to the customers and to see what they want and to keep the kind of books that people are willing to buy on the shelves, to go out and seek good collections of books, keeping watch over tired inventory and, getting rid of things as it becomes apparent that they're not going to find a buyer, and to keep sections interesting for people browsing in particular topic areas. We try to price things fairly. We will usually not charge more than half price for anything which is in print and try to arrive at a reasonable market value for things which are out of print. There is a market for first editions and collector's books, of course, and we try to keep in touch with the market there. But mainly it's, trying to find books for people that people want to buy. And I've done pretty well so far.
Well, you have enough books there for them to choose from. Now, if you were to identify your customer, give a profile, what would you?
There's quite a large range of them, and being downtown has expanded that range. But I would say our best customers are probably graduate students who are most in need of books of their own that they can use as they start advancing more seriously into their field of study. We do quite well with the older and more serious undergraduate clientele. I would say most undergraduates you probably never see unless they're desperately looking for an out-of-print copy or a sold-out copy that they need for a class. We do well with younger faculty who are still building up their own collections and a few bibliophiles among the older faculty. We get people who work downtown looking for their outside reading. We get visiting scholars, tourists, which Bloomington is attracting more of these days, alumni coming back to visit their old haunts, and now alumni of Caveat Emptor who want to come back to a place that many of them have happy memories of. Parents of incoming students, some of them old customers now with college-age kids of their own. It's quite a diverse clientele.
That's got to be pretty gratifying to see the next generation walking in your door.
It is gratifying. And it's nice keeping up with people I've gotten to know well and as they come back and update me on their own careers and their own work, and many of whom are quite successful.
There's no cash register. You just use a little adding machine.
And we have a drawer.
Yeah. And a drawer. And I don't see a computer, but how do people know about you? Are you on the internet from another computer or anything like that?
We are not on the internet at all, although that may change. We are probably going to be acquiring computer equipment fairly soon. And we will probably start entering some of our more esoteric or hard-to-sell or rare inventory onto the computer, into a database. And we will probably upload it on one of the large out-of-print book databases like abebooks.com, which other dealers use to unload their own wares. Because, you know, there are books that may be very good books in a particular field that just don't have a local clientele for. For example, IU does not teach engineering or many of the applied sciences. And there are, examples in all fields like that that just for one reason or another have failed to find a buyer, but that I happen to know are worthwhile books. And that somewhere out there in the universe is probably a customer who wants that. But, it takes careful planning because I don't want to start something that can't be done right the first time out, because it's very easy to lose your good name if you don't deal fairly with customers and don't have things organized for timely service, for example.
So you're going to go modern?
I'm afraid we're going to have to, yes. I have resisted doing that for a very long time.
Does that go back to the stubbornness you mentioned?
It goes back to the stubbornness. And I tend to be a creature of habit. I like doing things the way I've always been doing them. And anything that disrupts that, I tend to resist. But, I know that the times are changing. The clientele is changing. I get the sense that some of the younger students are less enamored of owning books than used to be the case, say, 20 years ago. And I'll probably have to start finding other ways of selling the good books that we get in.
Yanis, your early years of your life were anything but what we would call American normal. If anything, they were extremely difficult. Are you comfortable with sort of sharing your early years with us?
Oh, sure. I was born in Riga, Latvia, during World War II in 1943. After about a year, my parents felt that they really needed to leave because the Eastern Front was heading westward. And we knew that right behind the Red Army would come the Russian secret police. My father's family owned a small farm in central Latvia, and it was not very large. It was not wealthy. We didn't have hired help. But even that would qualify our family as class enemies or kulaks, and would make us quite vulnerable to arrest and deportation. My father was a botanist studying plant diseases for the government. My mother was a graduate student in botany. So they weren't really very important in any larger political sense, but they knew that their lives probably, or their liberty at least, was in danger. So we got out while the getting was still good and made our way westward into Germany. Lived by our wits for the last year of the war and wound up in refugee camps for the 5 years after the war until we found a home in Indianapolis. I learned how to read and write before coming over here in Latvian. And so when I got here, not knowing very many words of English, I was sort of tossed into school, sink or swim. I already knew about the alphabet. I knew about, words and letters and sounds, and I just simply had to learn new names for things. And at the age of 7, you're pretty resilient in that regard, and as I was, and it didn't take very many months before I was chattering like a magpie. And I think by the time I finished high school, I knew English better than, 99% of the population.
Before we go on, why don't we play some music and play some from Latvia, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You have a Latvian folk song with a...
Yes, this is it's a folk song about a young man wishing that the wind would blow him back to his homeland and to his sweetheart. And it is very near and dear to a lot of Latvian hearts.
And this is sung by a Latvian women's choir?
Yes, it is.
Okay. We have just heard a Latvian folk song sung by a Latvian women's choir. It's a special selection of our guest today, Jana Starks. Now, you selected that because?
Well, the reason I selected that is that my Latvian heritage is still very important to me, even though most of my daily activities involve around intense use of the English language. And perusal and understanding thereof, my Latvian heritage is still very important to me. And I still read Latvian. I speak Latvian with a Latvian friend and my mother, who is still living. I love Latvian music, including the folk songs, of which that is a nice example.
Now, you're 7 years old. You're in Indianapolis. What followed that, and how did you get to Bloomington?
The Lutheran World Federation and the local Lutheran minister helped my father find a job as a groundskeeper for Eli Lilly. Unfortunately, his health was not as good as it might be, and a few years afterwards, he died suddenly of a heart attack. My mother had to find work. Although Mr. Lilly was very, very gracious in helping us out during our times of trial. And after some retraining at Butler University, my mother found work as a medical technologist at General Hospital in Indianapolis, worked in the dermatology lab. And so she raised me through high school as a single mother. I took to learning like a duck took to water.
Well, you went to a special high school. I mean, a high school that has a real heritage, as I recall.
It did. I was lucky through most of my years in school to have had at least a few good teachers every time to sort of encourage my love for learning and to keep me motivated. I was extremely lucky in being able to go to Shortridge High School, which at the time in the late 50s, early 60s was still the best academic high school in Indianapolis and one of the best in the state. I was able to find teachers who still believed in what has now become a quaint notion of learning being good for its own sake, and who demanded much of the students that they knew were capable of it and did not let us coast if we were ever tempted to do so. I managed to find in that largest school a group of friends who all were also interested in learning and education, who liked good music, and who encouraged each other against the pressures to conform to a fairly unforgiving and conformist crowd, which teenagers tend to be.
When you say good music, you mean classical music?
I mean classical music.
Okay.
Although as time went on, we also got wind of the folk music movement, which was burgeoning at that time and starting to be noticed in the general public. And also a little bit later on, jazz as well, which was, you know, America's contribution to the art form, you might say. And which took a little while for me to get into, but by the time I got to college, I was quite familiar with it and have been learning ever since. I was also lucky in that we had our school board reached an agreement with the Indianapolis Symphony to sponsor something called the Music Memory Contest, which encouraged students of various age levels to memorize either 8, 16, or 24 compositions. And then the students would go to a Butler field house and the symphony would play a few minutes of each selection. And then the students would write down what it was they had just heard and who composed it. And it might not seem like much. It was a gimmick, you might say. And it was a gimmick, but it worked in my instance, and I think perhaps in some others as well.
It was a training ground for either game then, right?
Well, you might say that, and you might smile, but more importantly, it got me to listening to music in a really intense way and to get inside the music, to understand what made it tick and how it was put together and how various portions of a longer piece fit together. And it made me love the music. There are selections I learned back then, like Schubert's Unfinished Symphony or Beethoven's Fifth or the Eroica, that I will never forget, and I will probably know note for note to my dying day. And it got me interested. And by the time I was in high school and meeting friends who had similar interests, we managed to organize ourselves into a classical music club that met after school every week. In fact, we even chartered a bus a couple of times down to Bloomington to visit the last 2 years that the Metropolitan Opera Touring Company stopped in Bloomington before they were dropped because they weren't able to have a long enough run. And the first opera I ever saw on the stage was Don Giovanni by Mozart, who is still my favorite opera composer to this day. And Don Giovanni is still one of my very favorite operas.
Well, you know, that's sort of a segue. We might as well use it. One of the selections you have is from Don Giovanni.
Yes, it is. This is the catalog aria, and it is sung by Bryn Terfel, who is one of my very favorite singers of today.
And it's the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra with James Levine.
Yes.
Well, why don't we hear it?
Madamina, il catalogo è questo. Delle belle chiamò il padron mio, un catalogo è lì che ho fatto io. Osservate, leggete con me, osservate, leggete con me. In Italia 640, in Germania 231, 100 in Francia e Turchia 91, ma in Spagna, ma in Spagna son già 1003, fan fra queste contadine, cameriere cittadine.
We have just heard the catalog aria from Mozart's Don Giovanni, and it was sung by our guest's favorite singer, or one of your favorite singers. And who might that be, and why do you like him?
Bryn Terfel. I think he is one of the most gifted singers today. He clearly relishes what he does. Every time you hear him sing, you can tell that. And he has a real theatrical flair for getting into inside the words and meaning of a song or an aria or a role. And I thought that he will probably wind up being one of my favorite singers when I am old and when he is old. And I suspect I will probably own this recital and cherish it for years to come.
And he's accompanied by James Levine in the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. Just while we're here, are there any other singers that you would put in that category of favorites?
Well, there's quite a few. I think the first singer I fell in love with as a singer was probably Victoria de Los Angeles when I heard her do Spanish songs. Must have been back in the 1960s in her early Angel recordings. And I followed her career until she finally retired from singing. And I think I have just about everything she's ever recorded in my collection. Among currently active singers, I would say Jesse Norman would probably qualify. I would probably be willing to pay money to hear her sing The Telephone Directory. I tend toward lower voices with a somewhat richer overtone series, and among the higher voices, people with a healthy lower register. That's a sort of temperamental thing I think I must have. Among the sopranos and tenors, I tend to prefer the lyric over the dramatic, say Ellie Ameling, for example, or Leopold Simoneau.
Those are light voices.
And I have to confess that I have something that amounts to almost an allergy toward Italian tenors, and not much of a taste for the Verismo repertoire, which tends to especially invite tenors to misbehave.
You tend to do things your own way. Where did this maverick streak come from?
I suppose it's an orneriness that I was born with. I tend not to take anybody else's word for anything. I tend not to like to be pushed around or bossed. I don't care for smelly orthodoxies that people may want to impose on other people, or for other people telling other people how to live. I can still remember quite vividly that my favorite bookseller in Indianapolis, Keith Cuffell, who ran the trade department at the old Curry's bookshop up there, was arrested by a grandstanding prosecutor for selling Tropic of Cancer. And I have not had a sense of humor about censorship ever since that time. I can remember grown-ups trying to steer my thinking toward approved ways when I was in high school. The sort of establishment liberal viewpoint tended to be predominate in academia, which I noticed even as early as high school. One of the greatest pleasures I had when I was in high school was when I was a member of the Youth Council on World Affairs, subverting what the adults, what our grown-ups were trying to do in getting the kiddies to see things their way. It was perhaps a little bit perverse, and perhaps I might have been a bit of a trial looking back in retrospect. I think that we all learned from it. I certainly was kept on my toes while sparring with teachers and other students who might not see things the way I did, and I tend to do that even to this day. I don't think that anybody has a monopoly on the truth or on virtue, and the older I get, you know, the more skeptical I get about claims to that effect.
Well, I want to pursue this further, but right now we've sort of left you in high school.
Okay.
How did we get you to Bloomington, or how did you get to Bloomington?
Well, I spent a couple of years at Carleton College, but as sometimes happens, I had some trouble growing up. And I transferred to IU. I came down here to study history. And as time went on, I was discovering that people were declaring everything I wanted to do to be irrelevant. And the market was drying up for PhDs in history. And after a certain amount of floundering around, I decided that academia was probably not the best for me. And after a few years of doing odd jobs at Crane and at Otis Elevator, among other places, my friends and I all decided that we would be our own bosses and try something new.
So when you came to Bloomington to school, you just stayed?
I stayed. I never left. It's a very comforting environment for people interested in ideas. What got me interested in school in the first place was that I was always interested in the life of the mind. I wanted to pursue that in one way or another for the rest of my life. Sometimes I discovered that chasing trails of footnotes on the library stacks was not always the most optimal way of spending my time when I had papers to finish and grades to fulfill. But I certainly learned a lot while I was doing that. And I suspect that running a bookstore is probably perhaps the best way to make use of my dilettantish personality.
It also helps you express your real passion for the written word, though.
That's true.
And we've talked about your music club in high school. Was there an equal one for reading good literature?
There was. That we had a great books group in high school, and some of the most thoughtful teachers in the school were sponsors of it. And we would get together once a month and discuss a predetermined book, say, Brothers Karamazov or Crime and Punishment or something by Sophocles or John Stuart Mill or Thomas More.
This is in high school?
This was in high school.
Wow.
We would pick a great book. It was not necessarily something that was in that great book series that Mortimer Adler published, but just any great work of literature or philosophy or historical writing, like, say, Thucydides, something that would generate some fruitful discussions among the students. That was a very good way of exercising one's mind and of picking up firsthand knowledge of a lot of important writing in the Western tradition, and Eastern for that matter, because we discussed Lao Tzu and Confucius as well.
So you, in essence, self-educated in many ways.
Yes. I have always been an autodidact. Even in school, when I was in high school, I read more probably for my own pleasure than whatever I was required to do for a particular class assignment. And that's something I continued throughout my life. And that's something that my store actually is designed to serve. There's a long tradition in this country of people educating themselves, whatever their opportunities might have been for formal schooling. And that I always, you know, that I frequently encounter people who have never gotten out of the habit of reading once they quit school, whenever that might be, and who come back to keep their mind alive. I'm a resource for people like that because they can find affordable volumes to take home without having to pay new prices for books or finding books that are no longer in fashion and may not be in the new bookstores at any price.
Well, I don't expect you to have read every book in your store, but you have a pretty good idea where most of them are.
I certainly do. Every book that goes out there I have bought, at least for the last, say, 15 years or so. I have routed where it's supposed to go, whether I shelved it myself or not. I have created or co-created all the categories that books are filed under. So I have a pretty good sense of what we have on the shelves. And, of course, I have to straighten the shelves on a daily basis to see that things remain where they belong. Because browsing does take a very heavy toll, as I think all bookstore employees and librarians know quite well.
Well, you also have a number of compact discs in your store.
We do.
Some for your own personal listening and some for sale.
We do. We even have some vinyl, although not a very large quantity, but I think a choice one.
Well, you've become, as we mentioned earlier, one of the premier players of Ethergame. And how do you manage to do so well in that event week after week?
It probably has to do with the fact that I listen to an awful lot of music. I have owned a growing record collection ever since I started collecting in my early teens. I never miss an opportunity to look for bargains in either old vinyl or used CDs. And now, of course, since we sell them in the store, things also come into the store as well. And not everything that makes into the store will make it out into the bins. And over the years, I have quite expanded my own personal taste in listening as well. I started out initially with the usual repertoire that everybody learns to know and love, you know, say from Bach through Bartok. But as time went on and I got to know more of it more intimately, and I started casting about for new things to listen to. Initially, say in the 1970s, that was probably early music. I think for a lot of people who were not always sympathetic to what the new composers were turning out, much of which was quite dissonant and not very listener-friendly to the untrained ear, early music was the new music for a lot of people, and it was certainly the case for me. Because here you would have new sonorities, new harmonic language, new musical vocabulary that you could get into, some of which was quite startlingly beautiful. And then I started discovering quite interesting modern composers, people like George Crumb and Toru Takemitsu, who have found a new musical language, new sonorities, and expanded the possibilities that musical instruments and voices were able to make with real expressive effect. And that got me listening to new music, and that opened up my ears to people that had been, you know, sort of closed off to me before then. And nowadays, of course, it's no challenge at all because music has been branching out into quite a few different areas.
Well, there's a lot of new composers who sound like your early music composers, too, or at least
well,
write
many
that
of them
style.
Have been inspired by early music, I think, starting with Stravinsky's neoclassical experiments in the 30s and I'll say Peter Maxwell Davies and Luciano Berio. You know, and it's no longer considered a sin to perpetrate a tritone. You know, or as Arnold Schoenberg himself even wrote, it is, you know, there is still music to be written in the key of C major.
Well, you have shown this love for the early music with your support of Harmonia and the Early Music Festival. Is there anything from that period that you'd like for us to hear?
Certainly. One of my very favorite composers before Bach would have to be Josquin des Prez. And one of the people who first started recording Josquin des Prez's vocal music with great musicality was Paul Hillier and his Hillier Ensemble. And, of course, Paul Hillier is now on the faculty here at IU, as is one of the other members of the Hillier Ensemble, Paul Elliott. And I would like to play Lament for the Death of His Master Ökegem by Josquin des Prez, as performed by the Hillier Ensemble.
We have just heard the Lament for the Death of Ökegem was performed by the Hillier Ensemble, and it's a composition by des Prez, and the Hillier Ensemble includes Paul Elliott and Paul Hillier of the faculty here.
That's right. Paul Hillier is now the director of the Early Music Institute.
Wonderful singing.
And is doing similarly good work now with IU students in some of his newer recording projects for Harmonia Mundi.
Mm-hmm. And there's including some contemporary and some early music all at the same time.
Yes, I have noticed that Paul Hillier seems to follow a growing trend among musicians to have a simultaneous interest in early music and in contemporary music. And there seems to be quite a growing affinity between the two, and even with folk music as well.
You've mentioned to me on other occasions of your philosophy of politics. This allows you to have an open discussion and understanding of all sides of an issue without compromising your integrity or your own beliefs. Can you sort of elaborate on that for us?
Certainly. Ever since I started thinking and talking about politics in high school, when I really started getting actively involved in it, I sort of fell into the then growing conservative movement. And started quite early on reading the then important writers in the field, starting with Russell Kirk's Conservative Mind, which gave those ideas an intellectual pedigree and which got me interested in political philosophy more broadly. I have basically considered myself to be politically on the right in one sense or another ever since that time, although my tendencies have gone in a more libertarian direction in more recent years. But I certainly have no use for socialism or statism or various preoccupations of the political left. But since the views I espoused back then and still do were not met with universal approval among people I knew, I learned how to fend for myself in debate and quite vigorously. It was an important lesson because certainly back in the 1960s, people took it for granted that you could disagree with each other and still consider yourselves friends. We had quite vigorous debates. And we could disagree quite fiercely with what various of us believed. But at the end of the discussion, we could shake hands and go off and be friends and go out for a drink and have a lot in common otherwise. and that politics was not so personalized as it seems to be now, more nowadays. And certainly in my role as a bookseller, and in a role I had one time thought about taking up as an academic, it is not your place what to tell other people what to think. You can believe what you like, and if people are interested in talking about it with you, you can express your point of view. But it is simply not the place of a bookseller to tell other people what to believe. And I certainly don't. I don't want to do that, and I try to watch myself in that regard. I like to keep the widest possible range of opinions on our shelves. Given demand from the customers for these books, and I can sell everything from Milton Friedman to Karl Marx to Adolf Hitler, whatever has been historically important or has had a following or of one sort or another. I think all these books deserve a place on our shelves in case somebody wants to read about it for himself.
And just to carry this further, because unfortunately we've run out of time here, is to show your openness. We started with a folk song. We've heard Mozart. We've heard Dupre. And now we're going to hear Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington doing Mood Indigo. That's true. A great way to end. Janos, thank you. It's been wonderful to have the opportunity to visit with you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Profiles, a program where we get to know the people who make a difference in our lives and in our community. Our guest today has been Janos Starks, a member of the Ether Game royalty and the driving spirit behind the independent bookstore Caveat Emptor, which just celebrated its 30th year in business. This is Bob Willard. Thank you for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in August of 2001, Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash. Luann Johnson, research assistant. For WFIU, thanks for listening.